It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientific American summed up last year as wonder, awe, and discovery. That naturally leads us to ask, what will 2023 hold for scientific breakthroughs in biology and space, neuroscience, and beyond? Call in about what you want to explore in science news, the developments, the photos, the journal studies that caught your attention, and what it all means for future discoveries. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Helmuth is editor-in-chief of Scientific American, which has been publishing in the scientific realm since 1845. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So before we dive into the future, let's just take a moment here to level set on 2022. What made 2022 different from other years in discovery? Or was it that it teed up some really interesting things that might unfold this year?
Oh, it was a great year. Yeah, I think probably one of the biggest changes in 2022 was the launch and the successful kind of opening up and science to come from the James Webb Space Telescope. And it has, you know, the best view we've ever had on the universe. And within, you know, a few weeks of starting to get observations, it found really, really old galaxies that, you know, seem to have formed just maybe 300 million years after the Big Bang, which is like a minute and a half ago. In astronomy terms. And it's just been really exciting to see these, you know, really super crisp, gorgeous images of the universe. And we're expecting a lot more from the space telescope this year.
I can see in my mind's eye those images, the telescope releasing the image of the wreath of stars in a galaxy more than 200 million light years from Earth. What are you expecting to see next from the telescope?
Oh, next is going to be very exciting. So we know that the space telescope has been observing a solar system that's about 39 light years away called TRAPPIST-1. And what's interesting about this system is it has seven planets that are all about the size of Earth. And some of them are in what's called the habitable zone, which are about the right distance from its star that they could have liquid water, so potentially could host life, at least life as we know it. So we're expecting this year that we'll get the first data on the atmospheres of these planets. And so there's a chance that one of these planets will have an atmosphere that looks sort of like Earth's, and that would be really exciting for our search for life outside of Earth.
And it's designed to look at the infrared, I understand, and in the atmosphere of planets. How key is it that we can size up and understand the universe through infrared?
Yeah, it's a really powerful way to image the universe because it can cut through a lot of the dust and debris that gets in the way of other wavelengths. So it can kind of look deeper, and also it has much more fine-grained imagery. So it just has, you know, crisper, sharper, more detailed images. So you can really see like the structure of ancient galaxies and the atmospheres of other planets outside of our solar system.
Well, before we move on, do you think the telescope is going to find life out there?
Oh gosh, I hope so. I think that would be the biggest scientific discovery ever. Any evidence would be circumstantial, and scientists are still trying to figure out, okay, exactly what would count as life? How would we know? You know, what are the most important signals? And I don't think certainly in the next decade or so, I don't think we'll have absolute confirmation, but I think the evidence will be building that, yeah, they're given so many planets around so many star systems, everywhere we look in the universe, it seems likely that there must be life somewhere else.
Talking about science in the new year, what might unfold this year with Laura Helmuth, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. You can join in on discoveries that you're watching for, 800-642-1234. So moving on to New Horizons, the spacecraft that snapped detailed images of the dwarf planet Pluto in 2015, coming out of this so-called hibernation this year to study Neptune and Uranus. What are scientists hoping to learn from New Horizons?
Yeah, this has been a super successful mission. It it found that heart-shaped plane on Pluto and a bunch of mountains on Pluto and geologic activity. And so it's hard to know. These will be the best, the closest looks we've ever had at Uranus and Neptune. And so it's, it, you know, we could have surprises. There could be more geologic activity there. Pluto has ice, not water ice like we have in Wisconsin, but other kinds of chemicals that also form ice. And, you know, that it could be that Uranus and Neptune will also have things like that. But we should get some, another, you know, just more breathtaking images.
Why was New Horizons in hibernation?
I think just to save energy. It's been out there for a while, and while it's traveling through space, in between the, its target observations, they just kind of let it sleep, let it rest until it's time to wake up again and start looking around.
How will New Horizons be different than its, like, its forerunners, like the Voyagers in the 70s? I mean, speaking of allowing it to rest a little bit, I mean, that kind of leads into what is its anticipated lifespan?
Yeah, good question. It should manage to live at least a few more years. NASA tends to under-promise and over-deliver on how long these missions last. A typical Mars rover, they might say, it'll be a 9-month mission, and then it lasts for years and years and years, which is great. So it's hard to say, but the Voyagers are still out there sending faint signals, and New Horizons is also, you know, once it's done with Uranus and Neptune, and it's also imaged a bunch of asteroids and looked at things in what's called the Kuiper Belt at the edge of the solar system, it'll keep going. So we could be hearing from it for another decade or more.
Yes, like, what is the interest in the Kuiper Belt objects? Why are they significant?
Yeah, those are neat. So these are basically where most of our asteroids come from, and they're considered like fossils of the solar system because they're made out of the same stuff, the same debris that all of the planets formed out of. So you can get kind of a good chemical composition and understanding of what are the building blocks of the planets in our solar system by looking at some of these really distant asteroids.
Let's turn to black holes for a moment, and scientists revealing the first images of the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. Where do you think research is headed into black holes, going in 2023?
Yeah, black holes are a really hot topic. We had a special issue about black holes in Scientific American a few months ago. And one of the surprises of maybe about a decade ago or so is that it seems like every single galaxy has an enormous black hole at the center of it. So black holes seem to be having a lot of influence on gravity and how galaxies form and how they interact with one another. And it's really difficult to understand the shape of the universe and the nature of the universe. But some theorists think that if you understand kind of the edges of a black hole, that can help you understand the edges of our universe. So it's a little bit philosophical at this point, but kind of understanding that edge seems to be where some really weird physics is happening.
Scientific American Editor-in-Chief Laura Helmuth, our guide to the biggest science breakthroughs, the imagery we should keep an eye on, and how they affect research this year and beyond. Bring this home. Call in about your research lab and what you've stayed busy working on, the major discoveries and achievements, especially in bench science, that will propel us forward. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers around the globe and here in Wisconsin continually contribute to the buildup of knowledge and what is possible through science. We explore what these discoveries in the scientific community mean for our lives in 2023 and beyond. Join in with how you are thinking about discoveries and what has made you excited about science. 800-642-1234. We have Scientific American's editor-in-chief, Laura Helmuth, who is a cognitive neuroscientist herself, and she stays with us. Laura, let's turn to COVID boosters. The CDC says 15% of people eligible for the Omicron variant COVID booster shot have gotten the vaccine. Do you think are more vaccines and boosters on the horizon coming this year?
Yeah, they should be. And, you know, for anybody listening, if you haven't gotten your booster shot yet, this is a really good time to do so. We get more data, seems like every day, certainly every week, showing that the booster shots are really effective against the variant that's circulating now called Omicron. And it protects you from dying. It greatly reduces the risk of going to the hospital with COVID. And it also reduces how likely you are to transmit the virus to other people. So it's really important to keep getting these boosters. And it looks like, you know, they're very effective, but they don't last forever. And so that's why you have to kind of keep reminding your immune system to be on the lookout for this virus, to protect you when it encounters the virus. And the boosters will keep evolving, I think, as COVID does, as the virus keeps coming up with new variants. It's really fairly quick and easy to make the booster match whatever is circulating now.
Bring us into mRNA technology as we talk about these boosters and what this type of biotechnology development has meant to bring these vaccines to people.
Yeah, it's been amazing. It's such a really powerful technology because you can make very specific vaccines that help your immune system just be finely tuned, be on the lookout for a virus. And so we've seen how quickly we can make new vaccines to hit new variants of COVID. And then another exciting thing in 2023 is we're expecting human trials for a whole bunch of other types of vaccines through this mRNA technology, including vaccines against malaria, tuberculosis, herpes, shingles, influenza. So it's just the beginning of, I think, a great age of vaccines.
I think that's why it gets described as like a plug and play system. Like once a pharmaceutical knows how to make them for one disease, they can modify them with this mRNA technology for a completely different disease. I mean, what do you see in the capabilities in that to bring that, you know, vaccines to market quickly?
Yeah, it's so powerful. And it really is the speed, because when a disease really takes off and is spreading quickly, it's a race, of course, to try and protect as many people as possible and stop the disease from spreading, protect people before they catch it. So the speed is crucial. And it's also really safe. Because these mRNAs, basically what a vaccine maker does is just create a vaccine that has a little snippet of protein that looks like the virus that somebody could encounter. And so you're not exposed to a virus, you're not exposed to anything dangerous. It's just a little piece of protein that kind of prompts your immune system to get ready in case it ever has to fight the actual virus. So it seems to work really well in conjunction with the human immune system.
And from what I understand, Pfizer and Moderna, they developed their COVID vaccines using mRNA technology. Is there a challenge to ensure that mRNA is shared with the developing world? What does the future hold for truly global, equitable vaccine production?
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. For social justice reasons, for humanitarian reasons, we really, you know, everybody in the world needs to have access to these vaccines very quickly and inexpensively and conveniently. Like I say, partly just as justice issue, but also, you know, viruses don't stay in one country and they don't stay in one community.
They don't know boundaries. Yeah.
They don't, exactly. They have no boundaries. Yes.
Mm. Turning to the FDA now and RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, FDA perhaps looking to decide whether to approve Pfizer's vaccine for older adults, currently no shot for RSV. What are you watching for out of the Food and Drug Administration?
Yeah, we think we're really hoping that that the RSV vaccine will, you know, turn out to be safe and effective and continue. You know, so far all indications are that it should work really well. But of course, you know, you don't want to rush things too much. So the FDA will be evaluating it. Hopefully, you know, releasing it sometime early this year. You know, RSV, of course, is one of these respiratory viruses that's been around forever. And really, with the COVID pandemic, we've realized just how dangerous it is. And it's part of the triple-demic this winter with COVID and flu and RSV. So the other two, COVID and flu, of course, have vaccines, and RSV, we just really haven't had a way to stop it. So a vaccine could be really helpful, especially for the elderly, especially for children.
Talking about science in the new year with Laura Helmuth, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. You can join in with your science questions, what you see ahead, 800-642-1234. Paul is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Paul. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah. I was just wondering, what are the precautions being taken for the Omicron variant booster to make sure it doesn't hurt the immune system instead of just remind it for the protein?
Paul, thank you for that. So, you know, how can it affect the immune system basically and not hurt it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, one of the things that's kind of a little bit counterintuitive with vaccines is that, you know, when you introduce something to the immune system and you get an immune response, that's actually a healthy thing. And it's good for the immune system to have kind of a safe exposure to a virus or to a piece of a virus that makes it kind of prepare to fight the virus when it actually comes. So there's a really robust safety network there. I think these vaccines, including the Omicron booster, are some of the most closely monitored rollout of any medical intervention in history. And so far, the data have just been just astonishing that these vaccines are so effective and so helpful and really so safe.
Let's turn to healthcare now. The U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, making abortions illegal for millions of Americans, and here in Wisconsin, largely illegal. How is women's access to healthcare changing in 2023? What is the impact of science?
Yeah, this is for healthcare. This is just a really dangerous trend. There's been a lot of research showing that people who don't have access to full reproductive healthcare options have much worse outcomes, risk their lives. I mean, pregnancy is a very dangerous procedure. And, people who don't have access to abortion services are put at risk of death, of disability. If they do have the baby and raise it, there's a lot of, you know, unintended outcomes of, poorer outcomes with their careers, with education, with socioeconomic status, with earnings. So the science is all really clear that abortion is just basic healthcare, and that, you know, withholding abortion or making it illegal is, you know, drives people to do dangerous things, makes people impoverished, and is just, from a public health perspective, is a really, you know, just really bad policy.
What do you think of the likelihood of an over-the-counter contraceptive pill, like birth control pills without a prescription? Do you think that is becoming close to reality, or will it face challenges?
Yeah, that's a good start. There are prescriptions you can get now to terminate a pregnancy. You can do it surgically. You can do it what's called medically, which is through drugs. So these technologies have been also very well tested. They're very safe, very effective, pretty easy, pretty routine. And so that's another thing the FDA is looking at is, you know, how can these services become easier for people to access? And that's reproductive technology gets better all the time if people can just use it. Of course, the danger is that a lot of times the most dangerous pregnancies are, women don't realize that there's a problem with the pregnancy until much later term. And that's when you really need surgical abortion services, often to save the life of the pregnant person.
Do you think telemedicine and its emergence in earlier years in the pandemic, will that influence healthcare in 2023? Will you see developments there?
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, it's amazing. Before the pandemic, there were so many supposed obstacles to telemedicine that had to do with privacy, with insurance, with reimbursement. And it just seemed like something that could never, ever happen. And then the pandemic showed that actually it can, and it's a really good, convenient way for people to get health services, you know, especially people who, you know, don't have easy access to hospitals, especially people living in rural areas, or who, you know, just don't have the time or the capacity to get to clinics. The telemedicine can help people manage their health in a much more immediate and easier way. And so we think that'll really contribute to people, you know, managing things like diabetes, getting antibiotics, getting whatever they need when they need it. It seems to really be a change that will last.
Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American, Laura Helmuth, touring us through discoveries. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The publication Scientific American has its pulse on intriguing discoveries and why we should pay attention to them. And we learn how the big science news of last year will set us up for new developments and discoveries in the months and years ahead. Be part of this conversation on science. What matters to you? Perhaps it's stunning space imagery, black holes. Maybe it's artificial intelligence and the robotic capabilities in your discipline. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Scientific American's editor-in-chief Laura Helmuth, who stays with us. Laura, let's turn to the semiconductor ramp up here domestically. Last month, we saw that Taiwanese computer chip manufacturer TSM said it would invest like $40 billion in the coming years to expand semiconductor production in the U.S. What is the significance of building these computer chips domestically?
Yeah, it's computer chips. They run our world increasingly, and we're just more and more reliant on them all the time. So, you know, it's partly a matter of national security, of continuity, of making sure that we can get whatever chips we need. And so making them domestically will, kind of take them away from being a bargaining chip in international relations. And, computer chips are one of these technologies that just keep getting better and better all the time. Just steadily, they get faster, they get smaller, and it's amazing. They just keep getting better. And so having this technology kind of in the U.S. will also allow U.S. scientists to be a little bit closer to the development in the improvement of that technology.
You know, the Biden administration, like with the CHIPS Act, has poured tens of billions of dollars into chip manufacturing. Is this a wise investment? Will you see dividends on this in 2023, or is that too soon?
Yeah, good question. I think, 2023, it's a little hard to know if it'll happen that quickly. But I think everybody's really motivated to get these, get these companies going, to get the chip production going really quickly. With technology, things just spin up faster and faster all the time. So we could, see some benefits of that investment, within this year.
How much of an issue is training and workforce, I wonder? I mean, is it lagging in chip factories that need these technicians and engineers to make these increasingly smaller and more sophisticated computer chips?
Yeah, I think there will continue to be a demand for people who are sophisticated about manufacturing, about any kind of science, technology, engineering, math, medicine. These fields, I think, are really investments in the future. So if anybody's listening and thinking about what kind of career to plan on, what to major in, really studying science is a great way to have lots of options as you develop in your career.
Talking about science in the new year with Laura Helmuth with us, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. You can join in the conversation about the science news on your mind, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's turn to the renewable fuel standard, which you know, Congress created the program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to also expand renewable fuels. It looks like there is change on the horizon to this program. What are you following?
Yeah, it's been, 2022 was a great year for solar and wind in particular. Taken together, solar, wind, and hydro were a source of more energy than either nuclear or coal in 2022. And it looks like solar and wind just keep growing. The technology is another thing, that the technology just keeps getting better and better. And the economics get better and better too. Solar and wind get cheaper. They get more efficient. We're getting better at storing the power so that it's available for longer, not just when it's sunny or windy out. So I think we'll continue to see this energy transition pushed by federal legislation, by state support, and just by economics. You'll see that renewables are the future of energy.
What does the future look like for biofuel production in particular?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a really exciting area of research. It's not quite as available yet, but it does seem like it's one of the fuels of the future.
And your magazine has been reporting that biofuel incentives are likely increasing greenhouse gas emissions. What are the tensions there that we have to pay attention to?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, especially biofuels, if they're based on corn or other fuel or other, basically things that are foodstuffs, you have to worry about is the increased acreage that's used for biofuel. Is that somehow a net loss versus a net gain for how much carbon dioxide is put into the environment? I think probably some of the research on using biofuels from algae and other, kind of less agriculturally intensive sources is probably going to be a little bit more likely to be a net benefit for climate change in the future.
What do you see in the future year here for wind and solar and being able to incorporate these greener technologies in the existing grid system?
Yeah, that's one of the challenges is how do you hook up things to a grid that was, created decades and decades ago with different types of sources that were much more localized. And with wind and solar, of course, they can, the power sources can be distributed throughout a network. So that should be an advantage. It's just a matter of kind of retrofitting the existing technology for distributing power so that it can incorporate solar and wind throughout the networks. And this is an engineering challenge. It's not really impossible. Like, there aren't any huge technological challenges. It's really just a matter of doing it, of committing to it, and making it more and more feasible to incorporate solar and wind into all of our power grids.
I also really want to turn here, switching topics from energy to the Endangered Species Act, because this is something that you really have an eye on the 50th anniversary coming up here of the Endangered Species Act. The law is the primary framework in our country for protecting threatened animal species. How is our country going to be recognizing this such significant anniversary?
Yeah, it's a big occasion. I mean, 50 years ago, we came up with the Endangered Species Act, and thanks to it, we now have, the bald eagle has made an amazing recovery, grizzly bears, wolves, just so many species, especially birds. I'm a birder, probably a lot of people in your audience are bird watchers, and so they know ospreys are back and pelicans and all these species that could have died out without the Endangered Species Act. So it's really something to be grateful for, and it's a great example of how good policy can make the world a better place. So I think we'll see a lot of celebration of all the animals that didn't go extinct, that are still healthy and thriving thanks to this act. But it's also a good time to kind of look around and decide, okay, is this still the best framework for preserving species, for conserving wildlife habitat? So I think, it'll be tweaked, but I think fundamentally this idea that we don't want to let other species go extinct, that's still just really simple and powerful and clear.
Yes, I mean, what about that criticism that the federal government is taking too long to protect species, that the waiting list is considerable to be protected under the Endangered Species Act? How do you think those problems will be addressed in 2023?
Yeah, and as you can imagine, you know, for every species that's a candidate for being, you know, what's called listed to be considered endangered or threatened or vulnerable, there often are kind of local challenges because it implies, you know, if once something is listed, that requires certain conservation efforts to go into place to protect the habitat that's crucial for that species. And so, you know, one of the examples is a fish called the snail darter that was the subject of a big fight over a dam that was going to be built. And we have a story coming up in Scientific American showing that the snail darter actually was saved. So it didn't go extinct, it was preserved. We got the dam also. So it's a little bit complicated, but it just shows that you can make compromises. You know, there are ways to save species without causing horrible economic problems.
Also, there's the tension around whether the threshold for a population is too low to be on the list, that decreases the chances for a species to rebound. What I'm hearing from you, though, is many species have benefited and rebounded. Is it a double-edged sword, though? I mean, are there some that haven't come back, even though they were on the list?
Yeah, there certainly are some that have, you know, been on the list almost from the beginning that are still having a hard time, like the black-footed ferrets. You know, the population isn't huge. Red wolves are kind of a complicated situation because they're interbreeding with coyotes. The spotted owl is another issue where it's, you know, some of its habitat has been preserved, but is the population big enough to really survive? And it seems like different species have different thresholds for how big the population has to be for them to really make a comeback. And I think that's one of the top issues in conservation biology is understanding at a species by species level, how many individuals do you need in order to save a species?
Laura Helmuth, Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American, leading us through the scientific news and discoveries that are captivating the world of science and technology. Still time to discuss discoveries that have fascinated you recently, what you anticipate out of your research field this year, and what will be the biggest challenges to overcome in your science area. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Scientific American's Editor-in-Chief Laura Helmuth about the most intriguing advancements in science and technology and why we should pay attention to them and what solutions they bring to the world. Still time to talk about science and what's to come. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, let's turn now to weather patterns and climate. Our forecast suggesting that 2023 may be an El Nino year. How would that type of event change weather patterns?
Yeah, it looks like it will be an El Nino. And so we can expect even more rain and flooding on the West Coast like we've just had this week. Now, the West Coast is in a huge persistent drought, so this will help a bit. It probably won't be enough to end the drought, but it, you know, should provide some needed snowpack for the summer season. But it's also, you know, it could be really dangerous with dangerous flooding and just more rain all at once than we can deal with. So we might see mudslides and things like that.
The U.S. Drought Monitor says much of the western U.S. remains in severe drought conditions or even worse. What are the chances of this drought continuing?
Yeah, it looks like it's lasted so long and it probably will persist. This seems to be a kind of a new normal in the West. And of course, it increases the risk of wildfires, of severe heat, of infrastructure damage. And it puts a lot of pressure on water systems. So it's pretty dangerous. And, it might require kind of rethinking how to allocate water across the West.
How does it intersect with climate change and explain the term mega drought?
Yeah, mega drought is just a really, really bad, persistent, severe, widespread drought. And that's what we're seeing. And it does seem to be a function of climate change. You know, the climate, the weather has changed so much in the past several decades, and it seems to be changing faster all the time. So, you know, one of the things that we really need to work on in 2023 is better control of carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases, hopefully at a global scale. Because we just keep blowing past all these kind of warning signs, you know, don't have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than this. And we just keep making the problem worse.
Let's turn to social media, also in the science realm and technology. Last year, Google and Facebook for the first time took in less than 50% of the internet's ad generated revenue. And we've seen the calls for banning of TikTok on all government devices. What does this year look like for social media companies?
Yeah, this will be a really interesting year to see how things shake out. You know, a lot of people are leaving Twitter because of Elon Musk's kind of erratic behavior. And I think, you know, last night we saw after Buffalo Bills player Damar Hamlin, after he had a cardiac arrest, immediately Twitter was flooded with anti-vaccine trolls spreading misinformation and lies. And so that's just, you know, just the most recent example of how social media, if it's not monitored, if it's not regulated in any way, really bad actors can use it to just spread lies. And it's hard to know how to stop that, but it feels like we need to do something. So Twitter's in chaos, Meta or Facebook is also having a hard time with its business model. TikTok is really popular, especially among young people. And we're also seeing platforms like Post, Mastodon, Reddit has been around for a while, seems to be really solid and growing. So there are a lot of options for people who want to participate in social media to kind of pick a platform that they like.
Talking about science in the new year with Laura Helmuth, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. You can join in the conversation on science discoveries, what you're watching for, 800-642-1234. Erica in Oconomowoc is with us. Erica, what's on your mind?
Plastics. I'm really concerned about our use of plastics from plastic bags in grocery stores, and what that does to our oceans, but also the amount of durable medical equipment that is plastic and used in healthcare. And a good example of that would be these continuous glucose monitors. There's a lot of waste plastics with those things. They save lives, obviously, but there's a price to be paid. So I'm wondering what's on the forefront.
Erica, such an important question. Thank you for that, Laura.
Yeah, that's it's a huge problem because plastic is so persistent and, you know, we can fill landfills with it, but it's not going away. And we just seem to be using more and more all the time. And yeah, it's, you know, some kinds of plastic do save lives. They're certainly convenient. They're safer, you know, just thinking of containers, a plastic container is safer than glass if you drop it and it breaks. But yeah, we need to come up with much better ways to isolate and recycle and reuse plastics. With plastic bags, a lot of communities have had luck instituting just a 5-cent bag tax and getting people to use their own reusable bags at the grocery store. So little things like that can add up. And I think we need more and more of that. There've been some really innovative taxes on plastic containers that kind of incentivize people to recycle them and return them. So I think we need to see even more kind of clever ways of limiting how much plastic we use, really thinking about how to reuse and massively improving the recycling systems.
Yes, and keeping an eye on the recycling technology itself and whether these items in the recycling bin actually end up getting recycled. That has been such an obstacle, such an issue.
Yeah, it really has. It's we need people to be honest and to transparent with how these systems work. And you know, some I think work really well, but there has been some fraud, has been some, you know, kind of misbehavior and misinformation about plastic. So I encourage people, especially like local journalists, to keep an eye on the plastic recycling in their communities to make sure it's really being done right.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee with a question. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. I wonder if Scientific American could investigate geothermal heat. It seems that right under our feet is a potential heat. I've seen a program where instead of having a large acreage necessary, that they could drill straight down in one spot and access the thermal heat. It would seem to be a good article of interest for the heating industry.
John, thank you for that. Laura, what could you say about geothermal heat?
Yeah, that's a great idea. In fact, I'll mention that to our sustainability editor to see if we can get a new story on geothermal. It works really well. I think the challenge is it's a little bit harder to scale up versus solar and wind. But you know, at the individual home scale, a lot of people do have geothermal, and some larger office buildings are starting to use it too. And it does seem to be, you know, a pretty efficient and you know, and available and relatively inexpensive way to get power.
I want to ask you just how you decide what to cover, like when a scientific breakthrough is actually a breakthrough, when it is significant. I mean, whether is it because it's being published in a journal, or is it a tip from a lab, or, you know, maybe a tip from John in Milwaukee? How do you decide what to pursue?
Yeah, all of those things. If something's published in a research journal, that's often a good indication. You know, it's been peer reviewed. It's considered important by the other scientists who run that journal. When we have a big network of scientists that we talk to regularly to ask them what they're excited about. But we love getting tips from readers. So if anybody has an idea of a science story that they'd like to see, you know, we're eager to hear what people are interested in. We try to cover everything. It's, you know, the exciting thing about science is there's something new absolutely every day. You learn something new every day. And we just love sharing it with people and sharing the most exciting new things we're learning with people.
We only have a few seconds left, but you've been mentioning just briefly about the intersection of science and politics, of misinformation, of trolls. How much of an impact is that in the science community?
Yeah, I think the science community is very concerned about kind of a rejection of expertise, a rejection of science, a rejection of evidence that we're seeing in some parts of the population. It's definitely not true. Obviously, there are a lot of people who really care about science and really want to know how we can use evidence to make the world a better place. But as we've seen some politicization, especially among extreme conservatives, saying, oh, don't trust science, don't trust scientists. And I think that's just a really, really dangerous message for making the world a better place.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Been great to talk with you.
Laura Helmuth is editor-in-chief of Scientific American. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.